Major funding for On Point is provided by Liberty Mutual for all your auto, home, life, and business insurance needs. Liberty Mutual. Responsibility. What's your policy?
From WBUR Boston, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. We all know the pattern. Top bankers and financiers on Wall Street move into top jobs in Washington. Top officials in Washington become power players on Wall Street, the revolving door. When economic growth was strong and shared, Americans didn't much complain. When the banks have had giant bailouts and inequality balloons, people think twice. This hour on Point, the Washington Wall Street revolving door now, and what it means for the country. You can join the conversation. Is it good and right to have our bright lights moving between Wall Street and Washington? Or has something gone wrong? You can comment at our website, onpointradio.org, or on Twitter and Facebook at On Point Radio. Joining me first today from New York is Gabriel Sherman, contributing editor at New York Magazine. His new article, Revolver, about the job traffic between Washington and Wall Street, is in the current edition of the magazine. Gabe, welcome back to On Point. Thanks for being here.
Hi, Tom. Thanks for having me.
You take one big, very recent example and go way into it. We'll look beyond that one, but let's start there. Peter Orszag, remind us what his job was with the White House. Tell us where he is now.
Well, this piece, Tom, profiles Peter Orszag, who is the first budget director in the Obama White House. And when Peter left the White House last summer, he was casting about for his next career move. And in December, he joined Citigroup, the large New York-based financial institution, as a vice chairman. And when Peter took that job, there was a whole chorus of criticism that all of these high-level policymakers seemed to find high-paying jobs in the financial industry. And this whole debate was rekindled about what is the proper relationship between Wall Street and Washington.
Remind us just how powerful, just how close to the center of American economic policy Peter Orszag was in that position in the OMB, Office of Management and Budget.
Well, Peter was really the guardian of the Obama agenda. You know, the Office of Management and Budget really makes all the priorities of the presidency run. I mean, he needs to come up with the hard and fast numbers of keeping all these policy, all the parts of the policy agenda moving forward. Now, what is interesting about Peter is that he actually didn't play a role in the White House's banking policy. So this is not an explicit case of favor trading where Peter was writing banking regulations and was rewarded with a job after leaving office. But what is interesting is that he comes out of this mindset. He comes out of this world where he knows how the players think, and that is incredibly valuable to an institution like Citi.
So what's he doing for Citi, Citigroup now?
Well, Peter has really become a traditional investment banker. He is spending a part of his time advising Citi's traders on macroeconomic policy. You know, he's a brilliant economist and really knows how the world economy functions. So he's giving them advice on where the economy is going so they can make smart bets in their trading. But he's spending most of his time doing corporate deal making, which is buying and selling companies, advising CEOs on how to restructure their business and do financial transactions. So he's really becoming a traditional Wall Street deal maker. And he told me in this article that he wants to do this job for the next 5 or 10 years. So it really seems like Peter is rolling up his sleeves and wants to become a Wall Street banker.
Gabe, you report that he's probably making $2 or $3 million a year now. And this is, of course, with Citi. Remind us of the size of Citi's helping of the bailouts that Wall Street banks got back in 08 in the crash.
Well, Tom, that's a great question. And, you know, when Peter took this job, obviously compensation becomes political because, Citi was the recipient of about $45 billion in TARP bailouts. Now they've repaid that. But at the time, you know, many critics of Wall Street said that institutions like Citi only survived at the generosity of the taxpayer. And now here are government officials moving into jobs that are paying salaries that most Americans would, see as stratospheric.
Big money at the right time, $45 billion, is priceless in the middle of a crash.
Well, that's the debate. And I think, I think Wall Street would say that if Wall Street went down, it would basically be the end of the world as we know it. But here we are 2 years after the crash, and Wall Street is thriving while the rest of the economy is stagnant and, you know, job growth is anemic. And, you know, we see some bright spots in the labor market. But generally speaking, the wider economy has not seen the recovery that Wall Street has. And a lot of Americans are asking the question, why is it that this one sector of our economy seems to thrive in good times and bad, while the rest of us, you know, really are at the mercy of wider economic forces?
Now, the revolving door, of course, is not just Washington and Wall Street. There's the whole corporate world. There's the whole world of lobbyists, very big time in Congress. Congressmen and women and congressional staffers going more directly there than in greater numbers than ever before in history. You write in depth about Peter Orszag. We'll look more at that. But you've also got this great chart, What Goes Around Comes Around, reminding us over time of some of the big players who have made exactly this move back and forth from Washington to Wall Street. Just walk us around that kind of incredible, quickly, around that kind of incredible oval of people. And this is just tip-top people.
Sure. And I think, Tom, what's the fascinating point to make here is that this is a bipartisan issue. Mm-hmm. This is not unique to one party or the other. Both Republican and Democratic administrations have seen high-level policymakers both go to Wall Street and come from Wall Street. So some recent examples, obviously in the Bush White House, we had Hank Paulson, the former CEO of Goldman Sachs, who was Treasury Secretary. We had Neel Kashkari, another top Goldman official who was overseeing the TARP program. We had, going back in administration to the Clinton White House, obviously Robert Rubin, the iconic Treasury Secretary, the former co-chairman of Goldman Sachs, who went on to become a senior counselor to Citigroup. We had, Rahm
and
Emanuel.
And U.S. Treasury Secretary, of course.
Exactly. Mm-hmm. And Rahm Emanuel has spent time in the financial industry. You had Roger Altman, another top Treasury official, deputy Treasury Secretary. He runs his own investment bank, Evercore Partners. Larry Summers, a Treasury Secretary and also a senior official in the Obama economic team, was an advisor to the hedge fund D.E. Shaw. So I think it's endemic to both parties, where the best and the brightest cycle from these high-level government jobs to high-level jobs in the financial industry. And I think it really raises the question, I think this is maybe something we can revisit later, this whole idea of the meritocracy, or as we call it in the piece, the super meritocracy, where when you're at that stratospheric level, you've gone to the best universities, you've studied under the top economics professors, you really end up thinking a lot of the same things, and you don't see the worlds of finance and government as two distinct orbits. They often become the same world because you know the same people, and it's really a mind meld. I want to point out that this is not conspiratorial. You know, I think a lot of people think that this is sort of a direct conspiracy where government is out to help finance. I really think these people are well intentioned, and they think that they're making the right decisions. But when you come out of this world, you often can't see the system for what it is. And I think that's the debate that really we should be having.
You're right. More than just people seeing this as the same world, experiencing it that way, perhaps because they've known one another in different circumstances, maybe gone to the same schools. You're right. The most surprising thing might be the degree to which people like Peter Orszag see the government and Wall Street as essentially, quoting you here, Gabe, as essentially parts of the same industry.
Mm-hmm. Well, that really gets to the point that we make, which is that I think when you reach that level in government, you really think that, you know, what's good for Wall Street is good for the wider economy. And I this is more my analysis, but I sort of feel that when you know the president is out to make policy, you know, the worst thing that can happen to a White House is some sort of panic. I mean, what if the Dow drops 5,000 points and no president wants to see that happen on their watch, because beyond national security, their number one job description is shepherding the American economy. And so I think once you reach that level of office, it's really hard to roll up your sleeves and shake the system. And so we've developed this set of values where the values of the financial industry have often become the values of government. And I think this is a worthy debate that we should be having, especially after the financial calamity of 2008, where a lot of Americans said, wait a minute, this was 20 years in the making, this asset bubble that was created. And the regulators were there. They were present at the creation, and nobody, you know, inside of government really raised the red flags. There was a lot of people outside of government who were raising alarms. But the fact that no senior regulator raised alarms at the credit bubble caused a lot of Americans to think, wait a minute, is there enough healthy distance between the financial industry and government so that we don't repeat the mistakes of 2008?
Gabriel Sherman writes in New York Magazine this week, after lunching with Peter Orszag and looking at this whole revolving door, he writes, the close alliance among Wall Street and the economics departments of the major universities and the West Wing of the White House is the military-industrial complex of our time. Now, that's one thing, Peter, when it appears to be working for the whole country. But a lot of people have lost confidence that it is working for the whole country. You sat down with Peter Orszag for lunch. He was well aware of how his kind of move, and many others like him, plays into this populist anger.
Exactly. You know, Peter talked actually very eloquently about that. And I think, you know, his decision to join Citigroup is, a testament to the fact that he's really decided that he wants to become an investment banker. And like he told me, spend the next 5 or 10 years in this new job. So he was aware that by taking this job, he would be the recipient of some populist criticism. But he decided that that short-term turbulence, as he called it, was worth it for, you know, the long-term, you know, gains that he would get in learning to become a banker. But I think the larger point...
Good for him. Turbulence, it's the national outlook, you know.
Wow. Exactly. Well, I think the larger point is this perception, and that, you know, as I pointed out, Peter didn't play a hand in the writing of the Obama administration's banking policy. But there is this perception where, you know, average Americans say, wait a minute, you were inside the West Wing, you know all of these players.
He was right there on stimulus in a huge way.
And you're being hired for a very senior position at a bank. They see this as, you know, they're being hired because they know how the White House thinks. And that is, you know, that's the perception. And I think that's what a lot of people struggle with.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking today about the Washington Wall Street revolving door, the parade of officials and bankers working both sides, and what it means for the country. It's not new, but in the current era of inequality and economic stress, it's getting more attention than ever before, and it may be a little more highly populated than ever before. Gabriel Sherman is with us from New York Magazine. His article this week in the magazine is Revolver, looks in particular at the case of the recent director of the OMB, Office of Management and Budget, White House Budget Director, Peter Orszag, now a bigwig at Citigroup. And he's, of course, not the only one by any means. Jacob Hacker joins us now as well. From New Haven, Connecticut, professor of political science at Yale University, author of The Great Risk Shift and Winner Take All Politics with Paul Pearson. Jacob Hacker, welcome back to On Point. Great to have you.
Thank you so much, Tom. It's great to be here.
We're scratching our heads and trying to figure this out. You know, this is sort of like the wealth and inequality debate, when Americans have traditionally not been unhappy that people got wealthy. In fact, they saw that as a kind of motivator that moved the whole country forward, and so they were fine with it. Revolving door, it's not new. Joe Kennedy moved from Wall Street, became head of the SEC back in 1934. Okay, but here we are in a time when inequality is high, the economy's not working so well, and people just seem less willing to accept, Jacob, that this is okay. Are they right to have that concern?
I think they're right, and you're absolutely right that there's nothing new about money in politics. One of my favorite quotes comes from Mark Hanna, the great, you know, political fixer of the 19th late 19th century,
yeah,
who said, there are two things that matter in politics. The first is money, and I can't remember the second. money has always mattered, but as you were suggesting, the revolving door is spinning much faster than it used to. And it's spinning from Washington into much more lavish surroundings. And I think behind that are two big trends that have already come up. And I think Gabriel really does a nice job in his piece of discussing them. One is that there has been a huge growth in the lobbying and the influence industry over the last generation. I mean, lobbying is now a huge business, about $4 billion in 2008, up from $0.4 billion in inflation-adjusted dollars in 1983. We're talking about 15,000 lobbyists. And it's not just lobbying, of course. It's also that the value of the kind of policy expertise and political status of folks who work in Washington to firms, even those that aren't, even non-lobbying firms, has grown a lot. And at the same time, we've seen a huge growth in rewards at the top. So, you know, the richest of Americans have seen their incomes skyrocket over the last generation. And so people in Washington are basically facing a situation in which there's a lot more demand for their expertise and their influence, and there's a lot more reward for providing that. And I think that's, you're right that it's the backdrop of rising inequality and economic problems that makes this very salient, but this is a longer-term trend, and in some ways I think it's implicated in the rise in inequality that we've seen.
Inequality has so many impacts. I mean, you've said, first of all, just when it comes to putting together the teams that we need to help lead the country, officials there, they're in competition with people playing this great big money. You've compared it to a playground game of dodgeball where you're picking your team. If it's Congress, there are committees there for staffers, or the White House, they're up against people offering many times the money.
That's right. And, you know, this in the book with Paul Pearson, we talk about how the Obama administration, when it came in 2008, right now, of course, all of these folks from the administration are moving into lucrative private jobs. But at the time, the administration was trying to pull a lot of people out of the private sector, as well as even more difficult, out of congressional staff positions, and they were competing with lobbying firms. So one thing I would say is that it's not just the Washington Wall Street connection, but it's really the connection between Washington and a whole set of industries that care a lot about what government does. I would say healthcare is another key example. Anybody who worked for Max Baucus as a staffer, the head of the Senate Finance Committee, was suddenly in huge demand in 2009 and 2010. Because Senator Max Baucus was the central person on health care. Another health care story that I think is very revealing is that back in 2005, the head of the committee overseeing the negotiations over the prescription drug bill, Billy Towson, was actually negotiating at the same time that he was negotiating the bill. He's actually figuring out the terms of his employment with the Pharmaceutical Manufacturers Research Association, PhRMA. I think he ended up getting somewhere between $2 and $2.5 million to become the head of the PhRMA.
Everybody's got to go somewhere. Robert Gibbs, White House spokesman, is now a bigwig for Facebook. But here's the thing. I mean, people do need a job after they leave public service. Many people are not going to do that forever. But you've described just how short that bridge, that leap has become, so that when people are still in office, purportedly working in the public interest, they're already thinking about the agenda of future potential employers and maybe trimming, cutting, shaping their policy pushes to satisfy the employers rather than the public interest.
That's really the main concern. And remember, in all other parts of our economy, you know, and particularly on Wall Street, we think that incentives matter a lot. That how much you can make to do certain things is going to have a big influence on your thinking. So, and I thought Gabriel captured it well in saying that this isn't just about distorting decision-making while you're in office because you're looking at the prospect of future employment or the undue influence of interests that now are gaining the expertise of these folks who've been working in Washington. It's also about the sort of what sometimes is called the cognitive capture that takes place when people are moving between these worlds, a very rarefied world of private finance or private industry where they're really involved in the sort of highest reaches of our economy, and they think that the interests of a healthcare firm or the interests of Wall Street Bank are synonymous with the nation's interest, and moving between Washington, that there's this real concern that the viewpoint and the ideas get distorted in a way that people are going to have a very hard time recognizing themselves. And it's a subtle process. But, you know, H.L. Mencken probably put it best when he said that it's difficult to get a man to understand something when his salary depends on his not understanding it. Mm. It's a crude view. It's a kind of strong view. But I think that it captures a real fear that we should have about this increased amount of revolving door activity that's taking place.
A subtle process, maybe, but not at all, not really hard to see. I've got listeners here on Facebook. Tammy says, what do you get? You get corruption. Ray says, you get a nation governed by the wealthy, paid for by the poor. Zeno says online at the website, says, you get an outcome like socialize the losses and privatize the gains. Simple formula for success. No wizardry or wonder, wunderkind required here. Gabe Sherman, Peter Orszag is a smart guy. He must understand the kind of public reaction that he's likely to get, and even the kind of policy consequences that come from this very close relationship among so many people now over so much time. You sat and had lunch with him, talked with him. What does he think about this?
You know, I think one of Peter's great assets is his supreme self-confidence. Inside the White House, he was known as one of the main players who could stand up to Larry Summers, who is a famously pugnacious and very confident man. So I think Peter has weathered this very well because he, you know, he's very aware of the criticism, but he has made this personal decision that this is the career path he wants to choose. And I think he's very comfortable kind of in the white hot center of populist animus, as I write in the piece.
But self-confidence is quite different from self-awareness or awareness of the consequences of he's one guy. Multiply that by, you know, by 50 or 100 or 150 or thousands.
Well, and I did. I asked Peter sort of repeatedly about sort of what structurally we could do to change, you know, to address the inequality question. And, you know, he was and this is sort of how I end the piece. You know, he was sort of honest and say he's going to exercise some modesty, that he doesn't have the answers. And I did some thinking about this, and I'd be curious to hear Professor Hacker's take on this, which is how to address the revolving door. I mean, do you put a moratorium on government officials that they have to, you know, spend 3 years after office, you know, that they can't move into private industry for a set amount of time, say 3 or 5 years after office? I mean, I don't quite understand what regulations, practical regulations, we could instill that would stop the spinning of the revolving door. It's just a very difficult thing because you're not going to attract really talented and ambitious people into government if you're going to tell them that, well, you can't take a high-paying job after government. So you're sort of left with the question, what do you do?
I want to look at how to stop and look at consequences as well, but we have a lot of listeners who have been waiting to get into this conversation, if I may. Gabe, Jacob Hacker, let me turn to some of them. First to Myrtle Beach, South Carolina, and Steve. Steve, thanks for calling. You are on the air.
Thanks, Tom. I just like to make a couple of quick points. The first is, just because Peter Orszag and Robert Rubin and all these other wunderkinds, as someone expressed the term, think that this revolving door is acceptable, that doesn't make it so. There's a sickness involved here, and it's getting worse, not better. If they really believe that, Peter Orszag could work for $500,000 a year learning to be an investment banker. It's not like he has a track record at Goldman Sachs. He's learning to be an investment banker, I think, by your guest's own insight.
And it's $2 or $3 million, not $500,000, Steve, just for the record.
Exactly. And he's learning to be an investment banker. He's not an investment banker.
But he brings value because of where he's been, and he is a smart guy, and he's been around the track. But you say you're worried about a sickness here. We'll look at that. Steve, I appreciate your call. Let me get another right here. Francis, Washington, Connecticut. Thank you for calling, Francis. You're on the air.
Hi, Tom. Kind of a historical question. Mm-hmm. I mean, the revolving door can be traced back to, you know, Carnegie, Doheny.
Back and back.
Of course, C.E. Wilson, who said what's good for General Motors is good for the country.
Mm-hmm.
But it used to be that most of these people came from producing industries. The financial industry deals more with fiction than producing industries did. Can somebody speak to that?
Oh, that's interesting. Jacob Hacker, is it different whether we're getting, you know, barons of industry coming in or barons of finance?
I think it is different. And I would just note that the CEO who said what's good for – actually, what he said was what's good for America is what's good for GM and vice versa was engine Charlie Wilson back in the hearings to be defense secretary. So he was moving from what was a pretty lucrative position in the private sector into a pretty unrelated, although there was a lot of GE defense production industry position in government. He was eventually appointed. He ended up cutting defense spending quite dramatically. And at the same time, other top executives like Marion Folsom, who was at the powerhouse photographic firm Eastman Kodak, mm-hmm. was heading the Department of Health, Education, and Welfare and increasing social spending. So I think there were these business government relationships, but it seems as if they were less distortionary. They were certainly a lot less common than they are today. I mean, one of the things to remember is that this is occurring all the way down the food chain. Members of Congress are moving into lobbying positions much more often than they used to. But it's also staff in both the White House and in Congress. Recently, Washingtonian puts out a list of the top 50 lobbyists. If you look at that list, 13 of those 50 are previous members of Congress. 21 of the 50 are ex-staffers. 3 are family members of members of Congress, and only 13 say they don't have a direct connection to Congress, although or to the White House. Although one wonders whether some of those maybe just aren't speaking of their connections. So I think this is a really it's an echo of the past, but it's a very loud echo, and it's much more common than it used to be. And as I said, I think it reflects both the increased emphasis on policy expertise for these private interests, which are lobbying government more actively than ever. And second of all, I think it reflects the fact that there is much more inequality. So the top jobs in the private sector are not just, you know, slightly more lucrative than a public sector job, but vastly more lucrative. For a congressional staffer, they're doubling, tripling, quadrupling their income overnight by going into a lobbying job.
Yep. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. Francis, we'll look more at the issue of how it matters that it's finance instead of, I don't know, steel or automobiles. But let's look right across that that food chain that Jacob's talking about. Ashley in Nashville, Tennessee. Ashley, thank you for calling. You're on the air.
Hi, Tom.
Hi.
What role does transparency play in this issue that we're talking about? Today in Tennessee, we have legislation that's authorizing local governments to withhold evidence that they consider proprietary and make it not subject to open records laws. And these same companies want huge tax breaks and contracts from those governments.
So but they don't have to sort of show what they're up to or maybe the consequences because that would be deemed proprietary, Ashley.
That's the million-dollar – well, in our case, it's probably the billion-dollar question.
Yeah, and that's not just Washington or Wall Street, but right on out to Nashville. I mean, Jacob, there you're describing congressional staffers and congresspeople in Washington. Ashley's suggesting, you know, over a much wider swath this is happening there. I don't know the details, but maybe in Tennessee it's hard to even know what's happening if you get that kind of legislation in place.
Well, I think we'll want to talk a bit about the role that disclosure can play in dealing with the revolving door. As Gabriel said, this isn't an easy problem to solve. But certainly disclosure has been a big part of the regulations that have occurred in the past. In 1995, there was a big Lobbying Disclosure Act that was passed, and that's one of the reasons we actually know how many lobbyists there are. Most people who, you know, carefully study these regulations think they're pretty inadequate. And I think it's important to recognize that disclosure also has to be, you know, coupled with, I think, some real shaming, if you will, when really egregious examples of this kind of movement between the public and the private sectors occurs. And, you know, that's a difficult area, but we don't want to demean public servants who have clearly done a great deal of good for our country. But at the same time, I don't think that it's acceptable. And I don't think that most Americans believe it's acceptable for people to really literally cash in on their expertise and their connections. And it's quite revealing. There's been a little research on this by some economists at the London School of Economics that staffers who go to work for private lobbying firms, that their pay is directly correlated with the continuance of the tenure of the senator they were once working for. So basically, if the member of Congress that they were associated with leaves office, they suddenly face a huge drop in their earning potential. That suggests that it's really the connections and not just the expertise that these folks have that matters. And the only way I think we can address that is to bring sunshine in and to say that this isn't correct, that this is wrong.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour about the Washington Wall Street revolving door, the parade of officials and bankers working both sides, and what it means for the country. My guest, Gabriel Sherman from New York Magazine, his big piece this week is Revolver, looks very closely at Robert Rubin, but especially at Peter Orszag. He was budget director in the Obama White House last year. Now he's a high-paid bigwig at Citigroup. Jacob Hacker is with us as well, professor of political science at Yale University, author of The Great Risk Shift. Let's get a call right here from Eric in Burlington, Massachusetts. Eric, you're on the air.
You know, most of us don't really know what's going on up at these upper echelons, but I think it's the public perception of this that really breaks down trust in our government. And I know some people that I respected that became active in the Tea Party, which I am not supportive of, but they really were angry at kind of this betrayal. And I know there are things that go on, but I think that most of us don't know, and it's really the trust that we've lost.
Which is a pretty priceless thing, pretty invaluable, necessary. Eric, I appreciate that call. Gabe, I want to come back to you once more here, because every time I ask how Peter Orszag looks at this, you're responding with his view that he's just changing careers, and he's going to roll up his sleeves and be an investment banker now. He's very self-confident. But he's got to see more than that. He's not just an economist. He must understand political economy a little bit. I mean, if you have a sort of a relentless tide like this, and then you get economic distress, and you get economic distress that is not equally by any means shared, he must be aware of the potential price to the fabric of our society if people get worried about what's going on here.
I think that's a fair point. I think, you know, what's really interesting, Tom, is in telling Peter's story, I tell the story of his relationship to his two mentors. You know, when he was a young staffer in the Clinton White House in the 1990s, mm-hmm. he worked for the economist, the Nobel Prize winner, Joe Stiglitz. And later in his career, Peter migrated to the camp of Bob Rubin, who was the consummate insider. And I think in those two relationships, you see Joe Stiglitz, who has carved out a very nice career as a public intellectual, who has become a critic of the financial industry. And then you have Bob Rubin, who has always been inside the system. He was Treasury Secretary. He ran Goldman Sachs. He then went on to be a senior counselor to Citigroup.
Made 100-plus million there in his time
as
chairman.
And I think what Peter saw is that in choosing the Bob Rubin path, that is the path of the establishment. That is the path that obviously pays a lot more money, but it also provides you with a certain public platform. It allows you to go on Charlie Rose and be, you know, part of this high-level national conversation. But I think the interesting point to look at is that as all of these questions about the revolving door get raised, I wonder at what point will people, you know, not want to hear from that point of view? And all of a sudden, the path of Bob Rubin becomes less attractive. And I think, you know, Jacob talked about this. I think one of the only ways to really fundamentally change the system is to change the culture. And that takes a long time. And that's a set of values. And that's a cultural shift. But I think if people can see that this kind of revolving door, this mind meld between Washington and Wall Street is not good for the country. Ultimately, you know, the next generation of Peter Orszags will choose to go back into academia or public service or the think tank world, and they won't necessarily think it's the better path to go to Wall Street.
Maybe you're right, but though all those millions make it pretty darned attractive. I mean, 100, what is it, 15, 35 million something, Bob Rubin on the other side of his Treasury Secretary service. What does Joe Stiglitz say about this? As you say, another former mentor of Peter Orszag, Nobel Prize winner in economics. What's he think about the revolving door, Gabe?
Well, Joe is a staunch critic of the revolving door, and I had a long and fascinating interview with Joe, and he's a very brilliant and forceful thinker on these issues. And he told me that he actually, you know, thought about trying to, you know, he wanted to do regulation to limit the revolving door in the 90s. And he was a sort of a big opponent of the Bob Rubin camp of the Clinton White House in the 90s. And ultimately, the Rubin camp won out. And Joe, I think Joe has some angst and some frustration that this issue is so central to the way Washington and Wall Street operates these days. And I think it's fascinating that you have, on the one hand, Bob Rubin, and on the other hand, Joe Stiglitz. And in the middle, you have Peter Orszag. And I think you can, in all of these relationships, you see sort of one of the structural problems that exists in the way the government operates.
Guy's got to make a living. But cumulatively, what have we got here? Sam in Everett, Massachusetts. Thanks for calling, Sam. You're on the air.
Hey, great show. Thanks for taking my call.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I think that, you know, earlier in the show you asked, you know, what's changed? You know, there's always been money in politics. And I think what's changed is, although it's very similar to the Gilded Age, is that finance is such a big part of the economy. And what's so incredibly screwed up is my own personal opinion, finance is what I call a parasitic industry. People don't work. They don't provide anything. They don't add value. They charge rent. That's basically what people in finance do. They find clever ways to charge rent. And it's all dependent on the rules and enforcement. And when you've got the people making the rules and enforcing it are the same people who are benefiting from the system, then you have the foxes guarding the hen house. That's exactly what we have. And what's different today is that after the great collapse, in the 30s, we had an investigation to find out what went wrong. And then we changed the rules, and those rules stood for 40 years. What's different today is no investigation, no change of the rules, and the same thieves are still running the system. Robert Rubin steals money from people like me and simple Americans who are just trying to get by. They don't earn their money. They take it from other people. And they're getting away with it because they make the rules.
Well, I don't know about stealing, but certainly there's a lot of questions about the financialization of the economy. No investigation, you say, and for that matter, even the regulations that have been put up are running into a lot of headwinds here. Jacob Hacker, this brings us back to you. I mean, you've written that the new economic environment that we're in, the new inequality that we're struggling with here didn't actually just happen by accident, kind of going to Sam's point, that in some ways we've got change by design here, that this is a result of lobbying and regulation and changing the law in such a way that it has produced what we're dealing with now, Jacob.
Well, that's absolutely right. And I do think, going back to an earlier caller, that Wall Street has a very special role, as it does in Gabriel's story, in these developments. One side of this is that the huge deregulatory shifts that helped finance become such a large part of our economy and also created such great risks for our economy were really driven by public policy and policymakers, some of whom, like Robert Rubin, had very close ties to the financial industry. And, there is a kind of almost a dog bites man quality to finding links between moneyed interest and Republican politicians, given that it's the party that's often been closer to business. But it's really on the Democratic side that we see the really strong connections with Wall Street. Sure, there's Phil Graham, the former head of the Senate Banking Committee, the Republican, who moved to UBS.
And pretty important in fundamental policy decisions.
But on the Democratic side, you have Robert Rubin, you have Rahm Emanuel, William Daley, and now Peter Orszag. And, it's interesting. It was revealing to me that when Gene Sperling came to work for the White House, people said, well, he doesn't really have any ties to Wall Street. He only made something like $800,000 from Goldman doing
chicken feed,
doing public service work, which is very revealing of what the new standard is of probity. So what I would say is that Wall Street not only benefited a lot from policy changes, but it also is a distinctive industry. Put aside whether it creates value for our economy for a moment, and just recognize that when you think about Wall Street, so much rests on information, access, networks.
Mm-hmm.
And it is also just an enormous source of huge earnings for those involved. And so those two things, I think, mean that there's a very high premium placed on access to elected officials and on people who have expertise within government on the one hand, and on the other hand, that it's just such an attractive place to go.
But it's not just access. I mean, they're serving in government, sort of going back and forth. Sam says fox in the hen house. You describe over time sort of fox building or designing the hen house.
That's absolutely right. And I think that the Eric, I think, got it quite right, that this has been very corrosive to people's sense of trust in government. I think there's no event that's been more damaging to people's belief that government can act in the interests of the broad middle class than the bailouts. And the way in which both parties have been seen as very close to Wall Street, and particularly the Democratic Party that was in the position of handling ultimately this rescue of Wall Street, I think has very much hurt the ability of people to feel as if government is acting in the broad public good. That's helped fuel the Tea Party movement on the one hand, and a lot of disillusionment among liberals about the Democratic Party and President Obama on the other hand.
Let me ask you something very particular, if I may. If we go back and look at the crash in 08 and the aftermath of that, one of the things that was put on the table was that the big financiers should give up their bonuses. Those should be clawed back. from earlier times when they were sort of, it now appears, pushing the whole economy toward this cliff. If you look at Peter Orszag, or for that matter Larry Summers, did they advise against clawing back those bonuses, or not?
No, I think most of the people that were around these decisions that had Larry Summers, who had worked for a time in the hedge fund industry and argued that that was really a distraction from the fundamental issue of rescuing the economy.
But doesn't that mean they kind of protected the bonuses? And these are this is big money of men who later hired them or worked with them.
Well, I want to be clear that I think that a lot of this is a reflective, as I said before, of a broader set of economic ideas that is very much influenced by these Washington Wall Street connections, but isn't reducible to them. So yep. I think that they believe strongly that this wasn't the right way to deal with the problems in the financial sector. Mm-hmm. I mean, what really concerns me is the systemic nature of what's happening now. As I said, it's from Wall Street to other industries that have deep pockets. And the degree to which we don't really have, there is really broad concern about this. You know, 53% of Americans said that the federal government helped Wall Street a great deal in 2010, and only 2% said that they helped that the federal government helped the middle class a great deal. We don't have, I think, a discussion that's going on right now that is a healthy one for dealing with this fundamental problem. And the revolving door is symptomatic, I think, of the more general way in which our politics has tilted in favor of those at the top.
We're trying to have that right now and right here with Jacob Hacker and Gabriel Sherman of New York Magazine. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. Chris in Greenville, South Carolina. Chris, thank you for calling. You're on the air.
I just hear everybody putting in their 10 cents and just discussing about this issue. What can we, the people, do to help prevent this type of situation? I mean, what can I do? You know, I hear everybody about what they're going to do. I want to know what I can do. I want people to know what they can do to prevent this type.
All right, Chris, it's the perfect question. Jacob, I'll come first to you. I mean, people listen to this. They see that this may be going on as you describe. They may worry that it's not healthy for the country, even if it's healthy for individual bankers' bank accounts and maybe a little more than that, but for the whole country. What can people do, Jacob? Where should they put their energy if they want to try and sort of balance the ship? I mean, this isn't a country that says no Wall Street, no finance, no wealth. It's never said that, but it wants a healthy economy that's reasonably shared.
Well, I think that the three areas that I would argue where most Americans should get, they should first of all get involved and active on these issues. That one of the things that that Paul Pearson and I describe in Winner Take All Politics is the degree to which the organizations that once represented middle class Americans, from labor unions to broad based civic groups, have really lost ground over the last generation, even as these very deep-pocketed interests have become much more mobilized and organized. You know, banks are very organized, and they have lobbyists. Their customers do not. And
so don't just be a spectator. Be involved somehow,
exactly,
somewhere. Get in there.
And even more specifically, there's got to be, I think, a reform agenda that has two parts. One is changing laws, but the other is changing minds and changing the culture, as Gabriel was saying. And I think that there was some emphasis on political reform at the beginning of the Obama administration, and it's obviously fallen to the wayside as economic issues have taken center stage. What I think Gabriel and I are talking about is the degree to which our economic problems are linked to changes in our politics, and so political reform really should be back on the front burner. That a lot of the demands that the concerns that Americans have about what's happening with our democracy are linked to the concerns they have about what's happening with their economy.
Gabe, how do you get through the curtain and figure out when somebody's not just talking a good game, but to our caller in South Carolina? You know, he wants to know what to do. Maybe if it comes to who to vote for. I mean, is there a buzz? How do you know? How do you know who's not, who's really wants to do something here and not just talking a good game, but part of it?
Well, there's a lot more resources than there used to be for those who get engaged to figure out what's actually happening. You got to watch what people do, not what they say. So, during a great example of this is when you look at the surveys in the 2010 election, people said that the number one reason that the economy was on the brink was was what had happened in the banking system. But those who named the banks as the problem voted overwhelmingly for Republicans, even though behind the scenes, the Republican Party was working to weaken the financial regulations. So, you know, people need to make their own decisions about where they fall on these issues and on the partisan spectrum. But more knowledge about what politicians are actually doing to shape the laws would help enormously in making those decisions. And right now, with the lack of the organization for middle-class Americans, it's really hard for them to get the information, the knowledge they need. And so this kind of general outrage doesn't translate into a specific targeting of those politicians who really violate the norm of political equality that we all believe in.
Gabe Sherman, we've just got a minute here. Mm-hmm. What's your advice? Where to aim the energy if people are feeling it?
I think it's a bipartisan issue, and I would just say that I think this is, like I mentioned earlier, endemic to both parties, and I think it should just be a broad public debate. This isn't about Republicans or Democrats. Both parties have stacked their administrations with high-level financial officials. And I think this should just be a broad cultural debate about why is it that Wall Street is the one sector of our economy that seems to have a special role that plays an outsized influence in our politics. And, you know, it should be no different than, you know, any other sector, whether it's manufacturing or agriculture or retail. I mean, it's important, but it's not the defining aspect of our economy.
Gabriel Sherman, his big piece in New York Magazine is Revolver, goes very deeply into the story of Peter Orszag, and more. Gabe, it's great to have you back with us today. Thank you for your reporting and thanking for helping us bring all this forward. Thanks for joining us.
Thanks, Tom.
And Jacob Hacker at Yale University, author of The Great Risk Shift and co-author with Paul Pearson of Winner Take All Politics. Jacob Hacker, thank you very much for your work and your time today.
Thanks for having me on, Tom.
Listeners, thanks for joining us. On Point is produced by Julie Jopp, Sam Gail Rosen, Rory Gallagher, Ping Wong, Eileen Amata, Stefano Katsonis, Hillary McQuilkin, Kate Osborne, and James Ross. Our senior producer is Karen Schiffman. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.